Go ahead, go there, and as you turn there, I want to read something to you that someone sent me this years and years ago. It's how to keep a healthy level of insanity. Or maybe I'll put it a little differently, how to make people think that you're crazy at the workplace. And it's just a whole long list. I'm just going to read some of them. Page yourself over the intercom, but don't disguise your voice. Find out where your boss shops and buy exactly the same outfits. Always wear them one day after your boss does. This is especially effective if your boss is a different gender than you are. Send an email to the rest of the company telling them what you're doing. For example, if anyone needs me, I'll be in the bathroom. Because now we have Facebook, so that, you know, people do that all the time, right? Put up mosquito netting around your cubicle. Every time someone asks you to do something, ask them if they want a prize with that. Put your garbage can on your desk and label it in. Put decaf in the coffee maker for 3 weeks. Once everyone has gotten over their caffeine addictions, then switch to espresso. When driving colleagues around, insist on keeping your windshield wipers running under all weather conditions to keep them tuned up. Now, I was actually driving down this street this past week, and I saw someone driving down one bright sunny day, and their windshield wipers are just going back and forth the whole way, you know, falling for a mile or so. They also had a WSU sticker on the back. Oh, reply to everything someone says with "that's what you think," and this is one of my favorites. Finish all your sentences with the words "in accordance with prophecy." And then finally, as much as possible, skip rather than talk. There is another way, however, to make people think that you're a bit odd, a little bit strange, if not crazy, and that's to live by faith. If you believe the Bible, if you embrace the gospel, if you live in line with the way of life that God has given us, if you trust in God's goodness, even when bad things happen, even in the midst of adversity, people will think that you are a little odd, if not insane. And I actually read this to you last week, for those of you who missed it, I'm going to read it again. This is from proactive atheist Sam Harris, and this is what he writes. He says, the only difference between believing in Jesus and thinking that you are Jesus is the number of people involved in each category. We have names for people who have many beliefs for which there are no rational justification, and he's including Christians in that. And when their beliefs are extremely common, we call them religious. Otherwise, they are likely to be called mad, psychotic, or delusional. And that's what some people think, and Sam Harris is not the only one. Well, if you've been with us, last week, you know that in Hebrews chapter 11, the writer introduces us to a long list of people who live by faith. But at the same time, these same people were considered weird by the world around them. Noah's neighbors, no doubt, you know, thought that he was certifiable when he, you know, began to build this big ship in his backyard. When Abraham left his home in Ur, you know, he's got this U-Haul, you know, behind him with a couple of oxen, and someone asked him, "Hey, Abraham, where are you going?" And he said, "I don't know. God told me to leave, so I'm going not knowing." Well, that had to seem a little bit off. And then people must have thought Moses was more than a few bricks shy of a pyramid when he left behind the wealth and the power and the pleasures of Egypt in order, you know, to not only risk his life, but, you know, to lead a pack of whiny slaves into the wilderness. It's been pointed out, however, that these same heroes or champions of faith were, as one writer put it, people that often perplex those around them, but please God above them. Now, if you were with us last week, we looked at the writer's definition of faith. He gives us that in the first three verses. But this morning, today, he begins to illustrate that or flesh that out with real people all the way to the end of the chapter. And so today we're going to meet the first of three of these champs, as well as misfits on the writer's list. There's a shepherd, a preacher, and a farmer. Almost sounds like a joke, doesn't it? A preacher, a farmer, walked into a bar. No, but it's not a joke. Abel, Enoch, and Noah. And we're going to start with Abel. So we're going to we'll read the runway, which is verses 1 through 3, and then we'll dive into Abel. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. And then now he goes off and it's just by faith, by faith, by faith. And he says, by faith Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts, and through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. So the writer starts with creation, and then he takes us back to the very beginning of biblical history. If you went any farther back, he would be discussing Adam and Eve. Now, some of you know the whole story about Cain and Abel. Some of you may not. So I'm going to put up Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. So you can have to turn a little bit back there. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep and Cain a worker of the ground. And in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. And so Cain was very angry, and his face fell. And as some of you know, the rest of the story, Cain fell into a jealous rage. He lures his brother into a field and murders him in cold blood. But the question is, why was God pleased with Abel's offering and not Cain's? Why was Abel's offering an acceptable sacrifice? And as you might imagine, both Jewish and Christian theologians have struggled with this and speculated about this, for centuries, probably about the time the ink was drying on Genesis, they started to think about this. All kinds of theories have been put forth. The truth of the matter is, we're not told directly. We're not told specifically. All we've got really is kind of a sanctified guess. But it's implied, both in Hebrews and in Genesis, that at some point after the fall, God must have, gathered the first family around him and explained the whole deal about offerings, why they were necessary, what was acceptable. And then as the story unfolds, it appears that the offering required was an animal sacrifice, the forfeiture of a life to pay for the penalty of sin. In other words, right out of the chute, and we've talked about this in Hebrews, right out of the chute, God intended to plant in humanity that sin means death, and forgiveness comes by means of sacrifice. Sin means death. Forgiveness comes by sacrifice. And it was a picture of showing what was to come. It was paving the way ultimately for the arrival of the Messiah and the cross. And Jesus' sacrifice, which was the sacrifice to end all sacrifices. Abel came just as he was instructed. He offered an animal, just as God had said, but not Cain. Cain, apparently, he grabbed some grain. He picked up an eggplant, maybe a squash or two. Who knows? Only God knows what it was that was, going through his mind. Maybe he thought he could get by. Perhaps he thought maybe God just won't notice. Maybe he came with sincerity. He just thought, God will understand and that will be good enough. And that actually might be the point of the story. Abel pleased God because he came God's way. Cain may have come with sincerity, but it wasn't God's way. Cain came his own way. Came
you know, came by the way of Cain. And that still happens. People say, well, you know, just as long as you're sincere, you know, that's all that really matters. As long as you're sincere, you know, as long as you're like true to yourself, God will be pleased. Well, no, not necessarily. God is pleased when we come His way, when we come to Him in the way that He's instructed us. And if we don't come His way, we're not coming in faith. We're not trusting that what He has told us is true. Remember, at the core, faith, you know, is trusting God. Someone has said, sincerity is not the test of truth, nor is it the measure of faith. Sincerity is not the test of truth, nor is it the measure of faith. And someone has said, the nurse who accidentally put sulfuric acid in a baby's eyes instead of silver nitrate may be sincere, but she's sincerely wrong. Faith is not simply a sincere leap into the dark. Faith is walking in the light. It's responding to truth. It's coming to God His way, not our way. And if He says, you know, it's by such and such a sacrifice, and that's the way, then there is no other way. Jesus didn't stutter when He said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through Me. Now, having said all of that, it is also possible that Cain brought a sacrifice that was actually outwardly acceptable. I mean, we're not told directly that only an animal sacrifice was okay. Maybe the offering of crops was perfectly acceptable. Well, if that's the case, then what was the problem? Well, it's possible that he came with the wrong inner attitude. It's possible that the trouble was that he came with a cardiac issue. He was harboring wrong in his heart. Kent Hughes, in his commentary, says the other reason Abel's offering was accepted was his hard attitude. Cain's attitude puts it all in stark perspective. The scriptures indicate that when God rejected Cain's offering, Cain became very angry and his face was downcast, thus revealing just how shallow his devotion was. And when God pleaded with Cain to desist and do what was right, warning him with a powerful metaphorical language that sin was crouching like a monster at his door and desiring to have him. That's a couple of verses we didn't read, Genesis 4, 6, and 7. He says God's plea was met with ominous silence. Whereas Cain's mother had been talked into sin, Cain would not be talked out of it. Our offerings are to be brought to God with humility and obedience and gratitude. But Cain seems to have come with jealousy and pride and anger. I mean, he was going through the right motions, but with wrong motives in his heart. And people still do that today, right? They say the right things, they do the right things, they come to church, they know the lingo, but there's no faith in place. It might, the outward actions might even be right, but the heart, the inner attitude, is not. Now, you know, we don't know if Cain came with the wrong sacrifice or the wrong attitude. Maybe it was both, either one or both. But faith involves right actions and a right heart. Anything else or less is just making up your own rules. Abel, however, he came with a humble, obedient heart. God was pleased with his authentic faith, and that explains the very last line that you read in verse 4, where he said, though he is dead, he still speaks. The poet Keats, apparently his epitaph, what he had written on his tombstone, was, here lies one whose name is writ in water. Think about that, just writing your name in water. But not if you live by faith. The truth of the matter is we are writing a portion of our epitaph every day, every day. And it should say something more significant than, I heard on one tombstone said, I told you I was sick. should say something about our faith. So that's Abel. Next guy is Enoch in verse 5. And this is a lot of people don't even know who he is. He's one of my favorite guys in the whole Bible. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death and was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. Three times in one verse, we are told of Enoch's demise, which wasn't really death. It was his departure. Twice, we read that Enoch was just taken up. And then plus, we're also told that he was pleasing to God. Now, let me give you a Bible trivia test. It's open book. What was Enoch's occupation? And what New Testament book tells us what he did for a living? An ominous silence fell over. No reason you should know this. Enoch was a preacher. And we're told that in the next to last book in the Bible, the little New Testament postcard of Jude, it says that he prophesied of the judgment of God. That was his job. He was a preacher. It turns out that Enoch lived in a civilization that had become so decadent that God made a decision that he was going to bring judgment upon the earth, and that's where the flood came in. But Enoch ministered in the days before the flood. He proclaimed God's word in a world that rejected his message. And you can bet people thought... Second, am I still on? It's just as crazy as a guy who was, you know, standing on a street corner carrying a sandwich board that says, you know, the end is near. They thought it was crazy. This is what Genesis 5 says about him. We'll put that up for you. There we go. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he fathered Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters, and thus all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. In other words, publicly, Enoch proclaimed a message that his generation resented and resisted and rejected. Privately, Enoch raised a son and then a family and walked with God. By the way, you happen to notice that Enoch became a father and then he walked with God. What was he doing for the first 65 years? We don't know. We're not told. A question is, was there something about the responsibility of raising a child in that kind of decadent culture that caused him to turn to God? Maybe. The miracle and responsibility of raising a child can have that effect. Remember what I read to you last week from John Ortberg? He talked about why he believes, and then he tells the whole long story about the birth of his daughter, and he finishes it up, and he says, when I held Laura, this little baby, I found myself incapable of believing that she was an accident. I found myself incapable of believing that the universe was a random chaotic machine that did not care whether I loved her or hated her. I don't mean that I had a group of arguments for her having a soul and believe those arguments. I don't mean this conviction is always present in my mind with equal force. It's not. I mean the conviction welled up inside me and I could not get away from it. I could not look at Laura and believe otherwise. I could not hold her without saying thank you to someone for her. I could not think of her future without praying for someone more powerful and wiser than me to watch over her. And when she arrived, she brought along with her a world that was meant to be a home for persons, a God-breathed world. Now, did that happen to Enoch? We don't know. We're not told. That's speculation. We don't know. What we do know is that he was faithful in proclaiming God's word, and he walked with God for a long time. That idea of walking with God is interesting. You know, what exactly does that imply? What does that mean? And we use that phrase and we throw it around a lot, you know, someone walking with God, because it's a biblical phrase. Kent Hughes, one of the commentators I look at, gives us some help. He says the metaphor of walking more exactly reveals how Enoch pleased God. He says it is impossible to walk together unless there are several mutual agreements. To begin with, you must agree on the destination. Husbands and wives know that the paths to Bloomingdale's and Eddie Bauer are not the same. You cannot walk together and go to separate destinations. Enoch was heading in God's direction. He says, but of course it is quite possible to be headed in the same direction, but on separate paths. But again, two cannot walk together unless they have the same destination and follow the same path. This Enoch did with God. And he says, there is one other requirement of walking together. Two must not only be traveling to the same place and on the same path, but also go at the same pace. Enoch was in step with God. And he says, we too must keep in step with the Spirit, Galatians 5:25. It's a picture, walking with God is a picture of intimate fellowship, a close relationship with God. The emphasis also seems to be on the endurance of his faith. 300 years. He was faithful. Enoch's faith was a long obedience in the same direction. It was Friedrich Nietzsche, of all people, who said, the essential thing in heaven and earth is a long obedience in the same direction. That was Enoch's faith. Enoch's faith not only got him a place in Hebrews 11, it took him to heaven without having to experience death. And I'm going to come back to that at the end. Now, one more thing. Before we leave Abel and Enoch, one more observation. It is striking to me that God puts these two men next to each other. Because there's a similarity and there's a contrast between the two men. The similarity is that they both live by faith. The contrast is that one was taken up to heaven without having to experience death, and the other one was murdered. Meaning what? Meaning, for one thing, living by faith doesn't preserve us from everything bad that can happen in a fallen world. Last week, I read a little bit out of John Ortberg's book, Faith and Doubt, and I read a little bit of it to you just a few minutes ago. Last week, he said, if you were to ask me why I believe in God, I suppose I would tell you the story about a baby. And then he tells that whole story about Laura, and I just read the end part of it to you. But on the next page, he says, on the other hand, if you were to ask me why I doubt, I suppose I would tell you a story about a baby as well. A couple whom I have known for a long time had a beautiful little daughter. She was the kind of child who was so beautiful that people would stop them on the street to comment on her beauty. They were the kind of parents you would hope every child might have. They had a pool in their backyard. And one summer day, it was so nice outside that the mom set up the playpen in the backyard so that her daughter could enjoy the day. The phone rang, and her daughter was in the playpen, so she went to answer the phone. Her daughter tugged on the wall of that playpen, and the hinge that held it, the side up, gave way. It didn't have to. God could have stopped it. God could have reached down from heaven and straightened it out and kept that playpen up. He didn't. The hinge gave way. And the side came down, and the baby crawled out, and heaven was silent. When that mom came outside, she saw the beautiful little body of her beloved daughter at the bottom of that pool. It was the beginning of pain that no words could name. She would have died if doing so would have changed that one moment, but she could not. She would have to live. The memory of how old her daughter would be would have to haunt her every birthday and every Christmas. And on the day she would have graduated from high school, that mom would live with the emptiness, the guilt, the blame, and the aloneness. And when that little baby left this world, she left behind a world that was God silent. Dostoevsky, who was a believer, wrote that the death of a single infant calls into question the existence of God. But of course, death has not restricted itself to just one infant. Elie Wiesel tells of the first night in a concentration camp and seeing a wagon load of babies driven up. There they were unloaded and thrown into a ditch of fire. Never shall I forget the first night in the camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget those moments that murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. And he says, this is our world, and I don't know all the right responses to resolve these issues, but I do know some of the wrong ones. When people of faith are not willing to sit quietly sometimes and let doubt make its case, bad things can happen. Sometimes people of faith can be glib. Sometimes they respond with bad answers. Sometimes preachers add enormous pain by telling people they have brought suffering on themselves by sinning. Sometimes they tell people they have not been delivered because they do not have enough faith. And that is a lie from the pit of hell. Abel lived by faith, and he was murdered. Tragic things can happen to people of faith. And we're gonna see that in spades by the time we get to the end of the chapter. God didn't promise us anything else. One commentator said, sometimes, as in the case of Abel, people suffer for their faith without temporal deliverance. At other times, as in the case of Enoch, God brings great deliverance in response to faith. But for most, the life of faith is a mixture of both. Isn't that true? And that's the reality of the life in a fallen world. Now, eyes of faith can help us see beyond it. Faith ultimately, will deliver us from it. But in the meantime, we live in a fallen world, and we must live by faith even when it's not easy. So there's Abel, there's Enoch, and then finally there's Noah. We're going to cover him a little more quickly. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. What Enoch prophesied actually was fulfilled in the days of Noah. God told Noah that things had finally gotten so bad that a flood was coming. Then he gave him, the blueprints, instructed him about how he's going to build this massive boat, a ship. Noah, he grabbed a hammer, he grabbed a saw, started to build. Faith is a decision to do what God tells us to do and to respond to what God has said. It's not doing something foolish. Now, having said that, when God's instructions are clear, we're called to be obedient, even when it doesn't make perfect sense. When God tells me to die to myself so that I can live, when God tells me to forsake in order to have, when he tells me to give in order to keep, that doesn't make any sense, does it? It's so much of what God tells us like just upside down from what the world tells us and how we should live. But I do it anyway, because that's the way life works. Steve Brown tells about a friend who watched him play golf one time and thought that his golf was so bad that he paid for Steve Brown to have a golf lesson by a local pro. He decided he was going to take the golf lesson from the pro. Became apparent that he needed a lot of work, so he began the lesson, really needed it, and the pro began to help him. And Steve said, you know, if you play golf, you probably understand this more than I do. He says, you know, it just doesn't feel right. You know, you're trying to figure out something and it doesn't feel right. And the pro said, it's not supposed to feel right. Just do what I say and you will get better. And then Steve Brown says, do you ever think that Jesus says exactly the same thing to you? You say, it doesn't make sense to me. And Jesus says, it doesn't matter if it makes sense to you. Just do what I tell you to do. And if you do right, you know, it'll come out right. The incredible thing was that Noah began to build this ark at the time when there was no clouds on the horizon. The sky was blue. He lived inland, so he had never seen an ocean. And yet he acted not on the basis of what he could see, but on what God had promised. And for 100 years, people laughed at him. They mocked him. They made fun of him. They thought he was crazy. Nevertheless, he believed God's warning, and he built the ark. And the result was that when the flood came, he and his family were saved, and his faith turned out to be anything but foolish. So here's the summary. Like Abel, we come to God his way. Like Abel, we come to God his way. I'm sure Frank Sinatra was very sincere, but his theology stinks. You know, I did it my way. No, we come God's way. Like Enoch, we're to walk with God by faith, staying close to him in a vital relationship with the living Lord marked by perseverance. This is Steve Brown again, and he writes something about Enoch that's just one of my favorite things. He says, the purpose of the gospel is not to get as many people as possible into heaven. The purpose of the gospel is to get as many mature Christians into heaven as possible. We're to be growing and becoming different. Perfect? No, we still sin, but we ought to sin less than before. You ought to be more obedient than before. There ought to be changes in your life taking place. When I ask you to give your testimony, don't just tell me how he saved you. Tell me how he's changed you. That's the nature of the Christian life. Becoming more mature, making us different, growing up, preparing us for home. And then he says, Enoch was an interesting person, and he reads the very verses that we've already read. Enoch walked with God, and then he was no more, for God took him away. Someone has described Enoch and God walking one day. They've been walking together for some time, all the years of Enoch's life. And one day the Lord turned to Enoch, and he said, Enoch, you're an old man now. We've walked together for miles and miles and years and years and years. You must be getting tired, Enoch. You know, I love you a lot, and these walks have been tremendous, but I noticed today that we've walked a long ways from your home. And in fact, Enoch, the Lord said, I think we're closer to my home than we are to your home. Why don't we just come on and go to my home? Isn't that great? But he says this, he has this. The purpose of the gospel is to get you closer to his home than you are to your home. So then when it comes your time to die, you won't have so far to go. Someone else has said, you know, if we walk with God, we get a head start on heaven. Like Abel, we come to God his way. Like Enoch, we are to walk with God by faith. Like Noah, we're to fulfill God's will. By faith, we build our life according to the blueprint that God has given us for life. Will people think we're strange? Yes. You know why that is? Because both our message and our times are like that of Noah. One last verse I want you to look at. Matthew 24, 37 through 39. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. And then Jesus said, and so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Many years ago, a pastor by the name of Bob Harrington tells of crossing a 17-mile bridge in Florida every day. And on one end of the bridge was an insane asylum. I would call them mental institutions now, I guess, but an insane asylum. And every time he drove across that bridge, he would think about it. And late one night, as he and his family were crossing the bridge, a man suddenly appeared in the headlights, and his clothes were torn, and they were tattered, and he was waving his arm frantically, and he was yelling for him to stop. And he knew that it had to be an escapee from the asylum, and he didn't want to stop. He didn't know what the man might do to his family. But he stopped anyway, and the man came over to his window, and the man was yelling, "The bridge is out. The bridge is out." And Harrington said he suddenly found himself running down the bridge, waving his arms in the same way, yelling, "The bridge is out. The bridge is out." And that's our message, right? The bridge is out. People are lost. And people may pass us by and think we're crazy. But the bridge is out. The bridge is, that's the bad news. The good news is that Jesus bridged the chasm at the cross. And to trust him is anything but crazy. You think about that.